The Chai FM, Eye on Terrorism, exclusively on Chai FM.
David Harris, a very good morning to you. Shavua Tov, how are you?
Good morning to you and all your listeners. I'm recovering from flu, so if I cough in the middle, please forgive me. But apart from that, top of the morning.
But hold on, was it man flu?
You know what? You're not meant to say that. The woman who used to sit in this chair, who has the afternoon slot,
yes,
that's what she used
that
to
one.
Accuse me of. You don't need to be on her side.
Oh, I'm so not. I think that the women, the reason that they're so flippant about it is because they've never had man flu.
My wife said to me, when I was younger, I would get over it in 24 hours. And these days, I'm the wrong side of 50. It takes a week to 2 weeks.
Yeah, you know what? I also found, even when my kids were young, they would come home from nursery school or primary school with all sorts of horrible little things. They'd be sick for 15 or 20 minutes, and then I would land up suffering from it for weeks on end. I said to my wife, they're actually going to kill me one day, these kids. But I didn't realize that it meant something a bit different. Anyway, David, I do hope that you feel better, but we're saying we will excuse the slight croak in your voice, but you sound pretty good from here. David, the item that we wanted to discuss with you is this very difficult balance between the protection of human rights and being able to deal efficiently with extremism and terror. Because obviously the greater the state's influence and the greater the state's view into all of our lives and to everybody's lives, the greater the ability to detect terror. That said, it's a very, very fine balance between the two.
That's absolutely the case. Look, people in the West, especially, you know, growing up in the era, obviously, for Jewish people post-Holocaust, but not just post-Holocaust, you know, the Armenian genocide, what happened in Rwanda, and so on and so forth, that when we think about any of these issues about, obviously, in my case, I'm interested in terrorism, but terrorism, war, general policing, you know, on the streets of any town, in the back of our mind, and in many cases in the front of our mind, is also this issue of the protection of the rights of the individual, because we don't want to end up living in police states. We don't want to make the mistakes that, you know, people who are still alive today made 70, 75 years ago. We just don't want to go back there. And on the other hand, you know, there are people wandering the streets with knives, with guns, with motor vehicles, you name it, anything's a weapon these days. And we have to protect our citizens from that as well, of course.
So how does one achieve that balance? And is it different from country to country and society to society, do you think?
It's absolutely different. I mean, you know, you've got the obvious, excuse me, in your face places like Israel, which, you know, you can argue to what extent there is true freedom and true democracy in Israel. Of course, I would proffer that it is, you know, pretty democratic. But clearly, certain freedoms are curbed because of the risks. I'll give you a straightforward example. And this might sound like it's something very petty, but it gives you an idea of the thought process these days. There are lots of kids around the world in places that can afford it who have these, what do you call them, the little helicopters that you can fly yourself, you know,
drones.
You put a camera on them. Drones, right? Mm. Little drones. In parts of Israel, you are not allowed to fly drones because the feeling is we don't know what that drone is armed with. I mean, imagine, for example, some tourist comes into the old city of Jerusalem and thinks, hey, I'm going to fly a drone up over the old city because I want to get that great shot of the Temple Mount. Can you imagine the security panic that that would cause? Now, again, you might think I'm being trivial, but this is just one example, and there are dozens. Think about taking a cup of coffee onto a plane if you're somebody who flies. You're not allowed to do that in many parts of the world. So, yes, it absolutely varies. Again, taking the Israeli example, with the exception of flying on American Airlines, you can take a cup of coffee onto a plane, whereas if you're in America, you know, you absolutely cannot get away with something like that. And again, I'm bringing it down to the trivial, but the trivial are the things that affect you and me and everybody else. I've not even got on to the, you know, the much higher stakes of freedom of speech and freedom of movement and so on and so forth, which are curbed in countries throughout the world.
Yeah, so it is an incredibly, incredibly difficult one, the goalposts or the measure keeps moving, because, you know, whereas before 9/11, I don't think that certainly the Americans were worrying about funding of terror. Since 9/11, that became a way to crack down on these organizations. So therefore banks and transfers of funds became very, very much more controlled. It's not just the physical at the airports, but also things like banking has changed dramatically, in the wake of a terror-filled world.
Absolutely. In the case of the United States, and it's not just America, but I just happen to work with them, the Treasury has a whole massive department that's dealing with terror financing and watching everything that goes through banks. Then the question becomes, okay, so we head towards, things like Bitcoin and so on. How do you monitor those? The terrorists find all sorts of ways of getting around the types of things that you've just monitored. And quite often at the end of the day, and this is where a lot of human rights groups start screaming and shouting, it's the regular members of the public who pay the price, both, by the way, in terms of increased taxation, because we have to cover these types of things, but also in terms of the restrictions, in terms of the extra documentation that the banks demand from you these days to make sure that that your money is kosher or halal, as opposed to what's been transferred by terrorists or state sponsors of terrorism like Iran.
The question is, how do we keep an eye on governments in order to ensure that this is a genuine issue of curtailing and keeping an eye on terror, and not perhaps a way of just gathering more information, let's say for tax-related items or whatever it would be, to control and to be involved in people's lives?
I think it's a superb question. We at Clarion have an internal debate about this on a very, very regular basis, because we're covering a lot of these issues. I am personally of the opinion that we just have to trust our elected officials, and yes, those unelected folks who sit and do the work, the civil servants, and just assume that they're doing these things for the best. There are other people in my organization who say, over my dead body, I want to keep to protect as much as I possibly can. On a slightly different note, we recently conducted a poll on our website about information being relayed during terror attacks. My personal view is that the public should be kept in the dark as much as possible, and only be given information that is absolutely vital for their well-being. However, when we asked members of the public, the overwhelming majority who came to our poll said they want to know everything. They do not want the government keeping information from them. And the governments are walking this incredibly, thin tightrope on this issue. And it's extremely important, that there are those watchdogs, and it's really important that the government listens to them. But my bottom line is that has to take second place to protecting the individual.
Very interesting indeed. I'd love to hear your thoughts on 34519 or 0618951019. That's David Harris with the Clarion Project, continuing to do absolutely amazing work and very, very important indeed. David, you have a fantastic week, and we'll catch you next week.